Good morning. This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. As we speak in Washington, D.C. at American University, Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts is making a speech endorsing Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nomination. This follows Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, who provided her endorsement over the weekend. In fact, Ms. Kennedy introduced her senator uncle, who then made his endorsement official. The announcement had been released yesterday that the senator was going to be making the endorsement of his Senate colleague, Barack Obama. The Clinton campaign had been courting Senator Kennedy for some time, trying to get his endorsement. The question is how this will play out on the campaign trail, where Senator Kennedy is expected to actually make a number of joint appearances with Barack Obama. Obama's coming off a huge win in South Carolina, which has a very large percentage of African-American voters, and they overwhelmingly cast their lot with Barack Obama. It was a nearly 2-to-1 margin for the Senator Obama over Senator Clinton. Now they head into Super Tuesday, February 5th, where, of course, many urban states, large delegate count states are in play. And in many of those, Hillary Clinton is leading in the polls. Joining us to provide the latest developments and analysis on what's happening on the Democratic side is national political correspondent for National Public Radio, Mara Liasson. Mara, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, exciting times for those of us that are covering these elections. My first question, how significant is South Carolina? A big win numbers-wise, but how translatable is that victory?
I think it was very important for Barack Obama. He needed a win. It was much bigger than anyone had expected. And it was very important for him. I think he showed not only that he has overwhelming support among the African-American electorate, it also called into question some of the Clintons' tactics in the last couple of weeks. The exit polls showed that for people who decided in the last couple of days, and for people who said that Bill Clinton was an important factor in their decision, I think 2/3 of them voted for Obama. So in other words, there at least is some evidence that voters down there didn't like what the Clintons were doing. There have been a lot of accusations that the Clintons have injected race into this battle. But I do think what you said in your introduction is exactly correct. Obama, although this was a very important win for him, now enters the less Obama-friendly territory of the primaries, which are big states, many of which are closed to independents. In other words, he's going to have to fight it out with Hillary Clinton for Democratic regulars, registered Democrats.
Do you think that the dual Kennedy endorsements will make a difference with those core Democrats who at this point seem to be the base of Hillary Clinton's support?
Yes, I do. I think it'll be very important, especially in California and in places where there are a lot of Hispanic voters. You know, Clinton has really been relying on the Hispanic vote as her firewall. She got big majorities in Nevada, and she's going into primaries like California, where there are a lot of Hispanic voters. And some people have even charged that she has been trying to raise the issue of race, not just to remind her blue-collar, downscale Democratic base that Obama is a black candidate, not just a candidate who happens to be black, but also her pollster, her Hispanic pollster, Sergio Bendixson, was quoted saying that Hispanic voters don't have an affinity or a history of voting for black candidates. And if that's the case, and she's trying to appeal to the Hispanic vote in California, I think Ted Kennedy, who really is a hero among Hispanics for his leadership on the immigration bill, will help there.
I want to ask you, as a former White House correspondent, your thoughts on Bill Clinton's role in this campaign. I know that there are some senior Democrats who are very concerned that this, yes, he is kind of the head of the party, and in going out so forcefully supporting his wife's candidacy, that he risks fracturing the party further, and that also he tarnishes his reputation and his kind of, you know, his standing as a former president. Your thoughts
right
on that?
Well, in terms of the second concern, his standing as a president, I mean, that's kind of up to him. I mean, Bill Clinton has decided that that he wants to do this. He wants to campaign this way. This is a joint decision. The Clintons really are a team. They're not two independent operators. And I think that if Bill Clinton thought this was hurting his legacy, he wouldn't do it. But I think he thinks his legacy is getting Hillary Clinton into the Oval Office. And of course, he'd be back in the White House with her. And I think that's just not a concern for him, because it's much more important that the two of them get back into the White House. In terms of whether he could hurt the party, I mean, you do hear Democrats worrying about that. And I think what they're worrying about is that he's going to cause a rift in the party that will be very hard to repair if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, to repair in a general election. And that is a concern of a lot of Democrats. It's interesting. I think if the Clintons continued to engage in tactics that a lot of Democrats felt were divisive or racial, which is different than being racist, I think that the pressure would only mount on her if she was the nominee to put Barack Obama on the ticket, which is kind of ironic. Because I don't think that that was her original intent, to have an African-American man and a woman on the ticket. But I do think this is an extraordinary race in the Democratic Party. We haven't seen anything like it for years. It probably won't be finished on February 5th. But I do think the question of Bill Clinton is so interesting, because there's so many questions about it. Not only would he cause a rift in the Democratic Party, but it raises questions about what his role in the White House would be. I think the Clintons have dropped any pretense to being two separate operators. In other words, they are a team. They work together. Her whole campaign is premised on how close an advisor she was to her husband, and how much her experience depends on those 8 years in the White House. And I think that the question of a co-presidency is really going to dog them. And it's not something that they have resolved yet. And I don't think they're planning on it until and if she gets the nomination.
We're speaking with Mara Liasson. You probably know that as an NPR listener. You're used to hearing her on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, national political correspondent for NPR, and for the past decade also political contributor for Fox News Channel, where she's on Special Report with Brit Hume regularly. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the candidacies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John Edwards, as he has come in third yet again in one of these primaries, finding himself getting further marginalized in the campaign. But the question, of course, is if it stays very close, what role does he play down the road? We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Let me also bring into the conversation Democratic political consultant and partner in the strategic communications firm Fabiani and Lehane, Chris Lehane. Chris, you've been very close to the Clintons for many years. Your thoughts on the strategy of employing Bill Clinton so prominently?
Well, I would have to echo Mara's sentiments that this is just an extraordinary election. I thought the New York Times editorial last week, when they endorsed Hillary, was pretty interesting, when it noted that usually at this time in the race, Democrats are grousing about their candidate. You know, at this point in the race, in reality, people are very excited and enthusiastic about all three, and in particular, Obama and Hillary. Now, you know, I'm one who obviously is biased here, but, you know, I happen to think that Bill Clinton is a huge asset in the totality in the Democratic primary. I mean, this is the only two-term Democratic president since FDR. He's got an 85% approval rating with Democrats. You come to states like California, you know, which benefited enormously during the Clinton years, and people have an extremely positive opinion and viewpoint of him. He had 11,000 people showing up for an event that he did in Davis, California, a couple weeks ago. You know, I just think that he is a huge asset, both as a validator for the direction and the changes that Hillary's going to make if and when she's president. But I also think that he can be used and deployed in the same way that a vice presidential candidate is usually used and deployed once you get into a general election.
But I guess I wonder that people who are supporters of Hillary Clinton or trying to decide who they want to support, sure, in this Democratic primary already know that Bill Clinton is there. So when you put him front and center and he makes statements that some people can take issue with or feel are inappropriate for one reason or another, do you really get a net benefit out of there, as opposed to him being more a background figure and his presence but not his words out there as targets?
No, look, I think that you know, the guy is a former president. He is an enormous figure, not only in the country, but in the world. And I just don't think it's realistic to assume that you're going to put him out there and he's not going to be covered. I mean, what makes Bill Clinton very special is that he has a preternatural ability and talent to be able to communicate with people, oftentimes way ahead of whatever polls and focus groups are picking up. And I think having him out there on the campaign trail both saying things, but also just his mere presence, the fact that he validates his wife, the fact that he can talk about the types of changes that she's going to effectuate. I think at any level, no matter how you slice it, at the end of the day, it's going to be, it ends up being a huge advantage in this campaign. And, you know, look, the campaign is by definition a vote on change. Obviously, both candidates are talking about change. Obama is talking about trying to bring in a new paradigm of leadership. Hillary's talking with a degree of specificity about the specific changes that she will make when she's, if and when she's elected. And I think having Bill Clinton out there validating that very message is a huge advantage for the Clintons going forward. And I think that's why they're very well positioned as they head into these February 5th states.
You know, Mara raised the issue of the polls in South Carolina and how voters there responded to the presence of Bill Clinton. That doesn't give you pause.
I think you look at the demographics of South Carolina for justifiable reasons. There was an enormous African-American turnout. Obama is a historic candidate. The African-American community, again, for all the obvious and right reasons, was extremely excited and enthusiastic. And I think that's a great sign for Democrats in South Carolina and Democrats across the country. But again, I think at the end of the day, you know, when the argument is going to come down to, do you want someone who's got 20-plus years of experience of really effectuating change in this country at a time period when we have enormous issues in front of us, from the economy to national security, I think Hillary Clinton out there offers a very specific approach. And I think Bill Clinton out there talking about exactly what she's going to do and referencing it to the fact that obviously during his 8 years of the as president, this country really was moving forward is a tremendous validator.
Chris Lehane joining us, political strategist on the Democratic side. Mara Liasson, just before we let you go, your thoughts on how contentious and how close this race will be. Do you think there's any chance Super Tuesday will decide things?
I don't know. I mean, we just don't know. The problem with Super Tuesday, and we all have to go to school on this, is in the Democratic Party, it's not most of them are not winner-take-all primaries. So he's going to get delegates even in states that she, quote, wins. Mm-hmm. There's about 10 mathematical possibilities, I think. But I think it's very likely that it's not resolved on February 5th, that nobody gets the 2,026 delegates that they need. And 2025 delegates that they need to win. I think this is a race like we haven't seen in 30 years. Now, I think this is the way races are supposed to be. I mean, in the old days, everything was sewed up. We had a nominee practically after the first primary, and everybody got bored and went home. I mean, that is not the case this year.
This is sure a lot more fun to talk about. Mara Liasson, Thanks very much. We always appreciate your reporting for NPR, and thanks for joining us on Air Talk.
Thank you.
Mara Liasson, national political correspondent for NPR, and our thanks as well to Democratic political consultant Chris Lehane of the firm Fabiani and Lehane. We're taking your calls at 866-893-5722. This is Air Talk.
Do you have an old car, truck, or boat taking up space in your garage? Give it to KPCC. Donating your used vehicle goes a long way toward paying for the news and information you count on each day. It takes just a couple of minutes to schedule a pickup, and we'll send you a receipt for your income taxes. Find out more online at kpcc.org or call 877-KPCC-CAR. Thanks.
This is 89.3 KPCC election coverage on air and online at kpcc.org. Good morning, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. The National Weather Service says the rain should move out this afternoon. Stuart Cito of the Weather Service says, however, there could be more storms later this week. More than 11 inches of rain have fallen on downtown L.A. since July. That's almost 5 inches above normal. Geologists are concerned that even with the rain moving out, there's still a risk of mudslides because the ground hasn't had a chance to dry out. Well, get ready for a big announcement from L.A. city officials, a new campaign to remake downtown's historic Broadway corridor. According to the L.A. Times, city and private developers have earmarked nearly $40 million to begin the effort, which includes redesigning the street, fixing up some of the movie palaces, and restoring fading facades. The project sees Broadway giving way to a live theater district with a trolley system running down its center. The Bringing Back Broadway campaign will begin with a series of street and landscape improvements, and we'll have more from Mayor Villaraigosa later this morning. Sig Alert in Sun Valley on the 5 North at Lancashire. The right lane's closed because of a crash with an overturned dump truck, and there's a fuel spill, too. It's going to be slow from Penrose. In West Covina, the 10 West is congested from Sunset to the 605. It's 10:21.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The results of the South Carolina Democratic primary 2 days ago, our topic and where things stand 8 days away from Super Tuesday here in California, in New York, in Illinois, and in other states across the country. The majority of delegates are in play, and as we just heard from NPR's Mara Liasson, these are proportional contests, so it's not winner-take-all in the vast majority on the Democratic side. That means you could have an extraordinarily competitive race coming out of, not just leading into, Super Tuesday. We're taking your calls, and we begin with David in Santa Monica. Welcome to Air Talk. David, your thoughts on the South Carolina results and where we stand.
Hi. My thought is that I think Moore is right. This is the way a campaign should be. I think that Bill and Hill have to go after Barack as hard as they can, because whatever they throw at him is going to be nothing compared to what, if he gets the election, I mean, if he gets our nomination, is going to be nothing compared to what whatever Atwater Rove guy the Republicans have this year. And this is what this is boot camp, or, you know, preseason, or whatever metaphor you want to use for it. And I love this campaign, and I want to see them give him all that they can give him. And if he gets it, great. If he doesn't, you know, and Hillary gets it, great. And we have to band together around whoever our candidate is and take care of it. So that's my thought.
All right. So, David, your point is they get stronger. Democratic candidates get stronger through this. They're battle-tested. You called it boot camp. You don't see it as that they come out wounded and less able to compete, but instead more battle-tested. David, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's talk with Mary in Century City. Mary, your thoughts on where things stand on the Democratic side.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Yeah, my sister and I have been discussing this all weekend, and we're both on the fence. We were a little more pro-Hillary. Now we love Barack. He speaks beautifully. His speech was, I mean, almost as good as the Democratic National Convention speech was. It was a thing of beauty. But we're both a little concerned that Hillary and Bill. I don't know. I don't think I agree with David. I think it leaves a little bit of a bad taste in their mouths. You know, we thought she did a great job in the New Hampshire debates and really sold the whole idea of her experience, his lack of experience, her specifics, his lack of specifics. But she seemed like she was getting a bit personal, and it just smacked slightly of desperation. We're hoping, I don't know, we'll see how she spins it, but it made us a little uneasy.
All right. Mary, I appreciate it very much. Thanks for sharing with us where you and family members are at in the process. Barbara in South Los Angeles, welcome to Air Talk.
Hello.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I am really happy about this race. I think that the Democratic Party has an abundance of riches. I would be happy to vote for any of those candidates. I will be voting for Barack Obama because I believe that he is an agent of change, and I think that he has the kind of spirit and tenacity that he has shown in his work in Chicago to really bring people together to work toward a common goal and heal the division that we've experienced for the last 8 years. But again, were Hillary Clinton our candidate, I think we could all rally behind her. If Senator Edwards, former Senator Edwards, was our candidate, I think we could rally behind him. We have intelligent people who care about the people of this country, and I don't think that the Democratic Party has ever been able in my lifetime to offer this country a better choice.
So you're excited about it. You're whether your candidate gets it or not, you feel on the Democratic side you'll be well served.
It's like it's you can't lose. You really can't lose. I'm not a rich person, but I will be given money in the primary, and I will be given money to the candidate that finally gets the nomination.
Barbara, thanks. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. Delroy in North Hollywood, welcome to the program.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Doing well.
Good. Larry, I want to get your take on how do you think that the whole race issue has been blown out of proportion by the media, and as a result, an honest comparison between Hillary and Barack's position has not been able to come to light.
Well, I think one of the problems, and we've talked about this previously, Delroy, is that there are not huge gaps between them on positions. They are so closely aligned and in agreement on a number of different issues, even their health care plans, for example, which both are quite ambitious. But, you know, the big difference is whether there's a mandate or not. She has one. He doesn't have one. And so I think news media are always looking for ways that they can highlight the differences. And unfortunately, when it comes to race, you know, that's typically the most simplistic, most superficial thing that news media can latch onto as a difference. And then the question is, in this race, whether Senator Clinton's campaign has strategically tried to use race as a wedge on the Democratic side between working class voters who are the base for Hillary Clinton and in the voters who are younger, generally better educated for Barack Obama, and whether there has been a conscious effort to do that. And, I don't know. I think it's fair to raise that issue, whether it has been used as a tool by one or the other campaign. But I don't think the evidence is by any means conclusive.
But do you think there's a double standard? Because when Hillary was the front runner, Barack and Edwards and all the candidates somehow use her gender to suggest that, you know, because she was a woman, you know, people shouldn't vote for her simply because she was a woman.
Yeah, and I didn't hear that. I didn't hear those campaigns in any way trying to demean her candidacy because she was a woman. I didn't hear that. So I think gender and race are inevitable issues that are going to be raised around this campaign. But one of the things that Barack Obama is clearly trying to do is to make his candidacy transcend the fact that he's African American. The fact is, he's mixed race. I mean, that's the other reality of it. People refer to him as black. He's half black, he's half white. He is of mixed race, and he's trying to make his candidacy go well beyond the kind of appeal that we saw during Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton's campaigns, when they were largely aimed at and pretty much successful only in African-American communities. Delroy, I appreciate your joining us very much, and I think it's a legitimate question what role news media plays and which aspects of the campaign that they play up. Sewell, in the Mid-Wilshire District, you're on Air Talk.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say the fact that we're even talking about Bill Clinton tells us a lot about what we need to know about Hillary and her qualifications. Having been First Lady for 8 years is not any experience whatsoever. She has the experience as a senator that the other gentlemen have, Barack Obama and John Edwards, maybe even less. We're not electing Bill Clinton.
Don't you think, though, it's fair to give her at least some due because she was an involved First Lady? And I don't think anyone's arguing that being married to the president is the same as being president, having that level of responsibility, being in on all of the decision-making and discussions. But clearly, she was a very involved First Lady. Is there no credit that she gets for that?
No.
Really? Okay. All right. So you'd see it as though she's just anyone else running for office who has been a senator for one plus terms.
She cannot list the occasions on which she was thoroughly involved in decision-making processes at the White House. Did she sit in on national security meetings?
Okay. So your argument is, since she wasn't directly in those meetings, she didn't have that experience.
Right. And I think she's trying to tout his experience that doesn't exist. I think okay. That what another thing she's done in her campaign is allow people that she's associated with to appeal to all the sort of fears the Republicans had in past elections, like drugs and the fact that Obama's a person of mixed race, or he's black. And then she says, "Well, I don't know. I don't have anything to do with that. You know, that may be my husband. That may be someone who's involved in my campaign strategy." But I certainly don't feel that way.
Yeah, I was disappointed that she didn't come out and be critical of the comments of Robert Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, for his comments, which he denied being about previous drug use by Barack Obama. But I don't know how you come to any other conclusion as to what those comments in that rally were about. So, well, thank you for your call. Let's take one more listener call. This is from Kara in Hollywood. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi.
Hi, Kara.
I wanted to mention that I think that if not a free ride, Barack has been given a very soft ride by the media, who are afraid generally of seeming racially biased. Meanwhile, Hillary gets a very tough ride, and it comes through in subtle ways, and that Hillary gets mentioned in a derogatory way when Obama gets mentioned in a positive way. And I just wanted to mention, and then I'll take the comments off the air, that he he says he's running a different campaign, but he's got Oprah's endorsement and now the Kennedys' endorsement, and that's not different. That's more of the same.
All right, Kara, thank you very much. We appreciate our apologies for the hum on that phone line, but chance for our listeners to weigh in with their thoughts on the Democratic side, the South Carolina results, and Super Tuesday, 8 days away, including California. Now, coming up in our 11 o'clock half hour, we focus on the GOP side. We'll talk about tomorrow's very big Florida Republican primary, where so much is at stake for Mitt Romney and John McCain. Mike Huckabee needs to have a strong showing as well, and what's happened to Rudy Giuliani? We'll take a look at the Republican side coming up at 11 o'clock here on 89.3 KPCC.
Commercial radio is paid for with commercials. Public radio is paid for by the public. That would be you. Public radio thrives only when listeners like you decide to become contributing members. Those individual contributions are the largest source of the money it takes to pay for the high-quality news you hear every day. Become a member now. It takes just a minute or two at kpcc.org. Thanks.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We turn our attention to Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, a biography by New York Times writer Elizabeth Buemiller, former White House correspondent, and she has had an opportunity to see the workings of the administration very closely. She had 10 interviews with the Secretary of State, as well as some 150 with others who have worked with her, closely observed Condoleezza Rice's work, and comment on what motivates her professionally, what she is like personally, and of course, trying to assess, even as she is in her second term with the president, what her legacy might be. Elizabeth Buemiller, great to have you with us on Air Talk.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's talk first of all about trying to get a handle on someone who was in the middle of doing her job in this case. Very difficult thing. I mean, typically historians wait a good deal of time to provide that assessment. Was that one of the biggest challenges here?
Yes, she's a moving target. And the problem is that there's still a little, you know, there's a little bit more than a little less than a year left in her term, and she's got big issues still unresolved: the Middle East, North Korea, Iran, Iraq to some degree, and so it's very hard to come to an assessment. What I decided was that she was a weak national security advisor. That's made clear with my reporting.
Very marginalized.
And I think she's a better Secretary of State, but we'll know more later in January 2009 when we see if there's any kind of a deal this administration is able to strike in the Middle East.
One of the things I find fascinating is trying to get a handle on you know, what motivates her, because clearly to get to the level she's at, you must be very driven. That's a given for anyone in this position. But I'm always interested, well, what is the driver for people? Is it an ideological bent? Is it seeking to have power? Is it the excitement that comes from doing the actual work itself? In the case of Condoleezza Rice, there are a number of motivations that are there, and I'd love you to unpack those a bit.
Sure. I say at the end of the book that it's hard to know, you know, what she stands for. In other words, what drives her, you know, foreign policy, idealism, we're going to spread democracy around the world. So that was the goal of this administration, at least in 2005.
Which she had previously been very dead set against as a pragmatist.
Or was she, was she a realist, a pragmatist who had, you know, educated in the Bush 41 administration when she was there as a Soviet expert on the National Security Council staff and believed in power politics and we don't, you know, spread our ideals around the world necessarily. So I came to the conclusion that her real ideology is not realism or idealism or defending the citadels of freedom, but it's succeeding. And she's been she was a Democrat. She's voted for Democrats and Republicans. She was a concert pianist. So I think what drives her is success. And she came from a family in the segregated South, a middle-class black family, and that was inculcated her from day one, that she was going to succeed. She had what we now call helicopter parents, you know, parents who were hovering. They didn't
giving
have that.
Giving her books.
Yeah. It enrolled her in French class, etiquette class, piano lessons, ice skating lessons, tap dancing lessons, you know, book clubs. She was an only child, and she was the project of their lives.
Well, and then how does that play out as she becomes an adult in the ways in which she attaches herself to others who have grand plans for her?
Well, she does. I mean, she was going to be a concert pianist, and that fell by the wayside when she was 17, and she had been invited to come out to the Aspen Music Festival, a very prestigious music festival, and she saw that there were 12 and 13-year-olds out there who could play on sight what it had taken her years to learn. So she came back and told her parents, I can't do this. I'm going to end up playing the piano at Nordstrom's. You know, I can't do this. And that was when she wandered into a – they told her, fine, but you have to finish college in 4 years, and you have to find a major. It was now the spring of her junior year. So that spring, she wandered into a class taught by one Joseph Corbell, who happened to be, of all people, Madeleine Albright's father, the father of the only other woman Secretary of State. And he was teaching international relations and Soviet studies. And Condi Rice became transfixed by his intellect, his charm, his storytelling abilities, and his discussions of the Soviet Union. And that was when she changed her major and her life, really, to become to study the Soviet Union. And Joseph Corbell was really one of the first of a number of very powerful male mentors in her life who she learned from and attached herself to. Now, before I go on, I just want to say that I've had a lot of questions about where she's always attached herself to powerful men. This is true, but in her field at the time, there were no powerful women to attach herself mm-hmm. to. There were, men held the power between. So, anyway.
Well, and these kind of mentoring relationships right. are not unique to her. I mean, that's the other part of it
right.
as well. This is a rather typical thing in Washington, and
right.
essentially in any kind of field that's highly competitive and people are seeking positions of great prominence and responsibility, there typically is a mentoring process. So it's not like she's, you know, some helpless woman who
right.
has to attach herself to a man and that's the only way. But that is how it's done typically.
Right.
And in doing that, though, one of the things you point out is that she becomes very closely aligned with these. But there is
right.
a kind of commonality of mind in many cases.
Well, that's what her critic. And there's plenty of them cited here in this book, find so discouraging, frustrating about her, or upsetting about her, is that when she was in the Bush 41 administration as the Soviet expert on the NSC, she really adopted the views of Brent Scowcroft, who is Republican, as we all know, but a real classic foreign policy realist. You know, we're not going to, you know, push for democracy. We're going to do what we can do. And then when she joins this administration, all of a sudden she adopts this grand vision of this President Bush of you know, we're going to invade Iraq. But one reason we're invading Iraq is because we want to, you know, make the Middle East safe for democracy, which, by the way, they're not talking about so much anymore.
Yes. And so the question is, how does one change, if it's on a dime, you know, that quickly, or what's the evolution that leads up to it? We're joined by Elizabeth Buemiller, author of Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, A Biography. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
And this is 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. Good morning, I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. The oldest president in the history of the Mormon Church has died at the age of 97. Gordon Hinckley presided over one of the greatest periods of expansion in the church's history. Its membership grew by about 4 million under his watch. 80-year-old church apostle Thomas Monson is expected to succeed him. The University of Southern California recently convened criminal justice professionals and activists. They met to talk about challenges with crime and punishment in L.A. KPCC's Frank Stoltz reports the group discussed solutions, too.
A year ago, L.A. public defender Kimberly Wong helped establish a special court that directed parolees accused of new crimes to drug rehabilitation instead of prison.
It's very difficult to get buy-in from various law enforcement agencies at the front end who might think, okay, yes, drug treatment works, but you know what? We don't think the population you're describing deserves it.
Wong selected a sympathetic group, women accused of non-serious, non-violent crimes. The pilot project has provided 25 women with a range of services that has helped them turn their lives around.
Then the system says, huh, maybe we should have invested in this population in the beginning. Maybe we were a little too hasty. Maybe we were a little too rigid.
The next challenge, she says, convincing policymakers to expand the program to more women and to a cohort many people find less sympathetic, male felons. Frank Stoltz, 89.3 KPCC.
Global warming is a hot topic for would-be presidents. The next president's decisions could have worldwide consequences. We hear what both the Democratic and Republican candidates say and what they could do in office. On the World, coming up at noon today here on 89.3 KPCC. The 10 West right now congested from Vincent to the 605. It's 10:41.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, New York Times, Washington reporter Elizabeth Pugh Miller with us, author of Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, a biography published by Random House. If you'd like to talk with Elizabeth about her many interviews that she conducted as preparation for writing this book and about a number of her conclusions about Condoleezza Rice's career and her performance as National Security Advisor and now Secretary of State, we're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We were leading up to the relationship that Condoleezza Rice has with President Bush, and clearly this is a very personal, very close friendship and affinity that the two have for each other. On what is that relationship built?
Many things. It's familial, I would say. Condi Rice came to Washington in early 2001 to be National Security Advisor. And she left California, Palo Alto, where she was, as you know, she was provost at Stanford, only 10 days after her father had died. She had just buried her father. Her mother had been dead for a number of years. And she left her home. She'd been in California for close to 20 years. And she had never married, no children, only child. And she really embraced the Bushes as family, and they in turn embraced her. But it's a much deeper level. People talk about how different Condi Rice and George Bush are, but I think they're really much more alike on a fundamental level, which is that, both of them are products of elites. George Bush from the Northeastern establishment, WASP establishment, Condi Rice from a Southern black professional class. Her parents are both highly educated. Condi Rice, like George Bush, has been underestimated her entire life as a woman, as a black, often as the youngest person in the room. And like Bush, the two of them, I think, have, enormous self-confidence on the surface, but they also harbor a lot of resentments underneath, which come out. And I just think Condi Rice was an academic at Stanford, but she had a rough time as provost. She was a very controversial provost up there.
Well, her views anti-affirmative action would be against the mainstream there.
She tangled with women. She tangled with minorities. And I think that summer that she met George Bush extensively for the first time, 1998, I think he was a sort of he's very direct. He's not academic. To her, he was a breath of fresh air at a very difficult time in her life with the fights she was starting and continuing at Stanford.
One of the differences seems to me is, and both come from these families with very high expectations,
right,
in a sense of carrying something on, accomplishing something, bringing honor on the family. But he went through that period where he was the mess up, where his
right.
life was in disarray, and Jeb got all the attention as the fair-haired boy. In her case, though, as the only child, she apparently didn't go through that period. I mean, the worst is she didn't have a major till junior year.
Right.
The most lost period. So in that sense, they're different. I wonder, does that play into this at all, that there's something about that, he sees himself as a redeemed person and she sees herself as on this constant escalator?
That's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that. I don't know how much that plays into their relationship now. What I think is that they need each other in an interesting way. When they first met, they spent this long weekend together at Kenny Bunkport, the Bush family compound, in the summer of 98, when this President Bush was thinking about running for president. He was governor of Texas at the time. And his father had invited Condi Rice, his old favorite, NSC staffer, out for the long weekend. And over that weekend, the George W. Bush and Condi Rice bonded over in the weight room at Kenny Bunkport, exercising, fishing, talking foreign policy. And she saw, she became his tutor in foreign policy because, unlike his father, as we all know, he knew very little about the world. He'd traveled very little, even though he'd had all this at his fingertips. And I think she saw how much more he needed her than his father had. At the same time, George Bush was transfixed by her. Here was this woman who could talk sports, and believe me, she can talk sports. It's
her
not
dad
fake.
Is a coach.
She knows football. Like the people say, she talks about it like a player, and it's not put on. It's real. She could talk sports, and she could talk foreign policy in one digestible bite. He'd never met anybody like this before. So I think that's what that worked.
And as you look at leading up to the events of September 11th, I mean, she was very critical of the Clinton administration,
right,
and its efforts to, you know, take American values around the world, sort of that, you know, going back to Jimmy Carter, human rights as a
right.
basis for foreign relations. Very critical of that. But September 11th happens. We have the question of whether to invade Iraq following the military action in Afghanistan. What changes for her? Is it just that President Bush comes to this conclusion as the neocons in the administration are pushing that agenda, or is something going on individually within her?
Well, I think she changed and the president changed. I asked, because in the beginning, you're right, she claims, and I take her at her word on this one, that she went to more meetings in the early part of the administration about how to strengthen sanctions against Iraq as opposed to invading Iraq, even though people like Wolfowitz, we know, wanted to take military action from the beginning or get very tough. What happened with her was after 9/11, she says, they looked at the world in a different way. And you and I now know what they knew before 9/11. We know now how many warnings she got from Richard Clark, the counterterrorism chief in the White House, how much they ignored them dismissed them or didn't respond aggressively. Can you imagine what went on in their minds on that morning when they realized how much they had known about it? We didn't know then. We know now. And she says that so when I asked her, how do you deal with that, the guilt, whatever? Mm-hmm. And she says, you know what you do? You don't beat yourself up about 9/11. You don't. That's a direct quote from the book and what she told me. She said, what you do is you make sure it never, ever happens again. And I think in addition to a lot of people in the administration wanting to take out Saddam Hussein from the very beginning, they just looked at Iraq with different eyes and thought, we can't possibly take a risk that this guy has weapons. I mean, we can go – believe me, there's also – you know, they didn't look at it closely. We now know how bad the intelligence was. But I think her psychology changed.
I guess I understand, and as you say, you can debate this for years, whether invading Iraq was at all the right thing to do over concerns on weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein's intentions. So, you know, that leap, I think, at least is understandable. The idea, okay, there's the September 11th attacks. If Saddam Hussein is, we see what devastation this can
right.
Bring about. But then how you jump from there to saying ideologically we're going to establish democracy and Iraq is going to be the place from where it spreads in the military, that's a whole other huge leap from a defensive posture into that kind of worldview.
Right. And, you know, Wolfowitz said famously that the weapons of mass destruction, we used that as a reason to invade Iraq because it was the one thing that everybody could agree on. And what was interesting as I was covering the run-up to the war was how the rationale for war kept changing. First, it was, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And then towards the very end, right before the war, Bush gave a speech in Washington about how this Iraq was going to be the centerpiece of this new democracy in the Middle East. So they did that for a while as well. And that didn't work, as we know, either. So we will be writing books about why the United States invaded Iraq for 100 years. And what I know is what I know by talking to her, getting her take on it, getting the take of people inside the White House, this is these are big important chapters in my book. I was just trying to add to what was going on behind the scenes to try and explain this. It doesn't completely add up.
Yeah.
Just doesn't.
But it's yeah. fascinating, and it had to be for yeah. you as you're trying to piece this together
right.
and see, you know, what's the intellectual consistency or lack of consistency? What are the emotional factors that come into it? Because obviously, you know, for all of us, September 11th was a huge event, and it's not, you know, even for those leading the government, it's not strictly an intellectual decision. There are all kinds of emotions that are at play.
Well, that's what she – And don't forget, the president, after 9/11, he was the first president to get this. Every day got, first thing in the morning, the threat assessment, which is a stack of paper and a graph of all the threats in the previous 24 hours against the United States, foreign and domestic. And no other president had got this kind of unassessed raw intelligence before. And Condi Rice saw it every morning. The president saw it. The vice president saw it. Secretary of State, Defense Secretary. And people who saw it said it was terrifying. And it was, again, raw, unassessed intelligence. But it changed their mindset. And if you noticed in the 2002, 2003, the country to some extent had moved on after 9/11, especially if you didn't live in New York or Washington. The president didn't, because every day he got this. Every day he saw these threats. A lot of them, again, were crazy, but they wanted to see it. And I really think it changed his mindset as well as Condi Rice's.
Elizabeth Buemiller of the New York Times with us, author of Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, a Biography. Let's take your calls and hear some of your thoughts. James in Beverly Hills, welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening, and I'm interested in this perspective of Condi Rice, but I have to say that I think that the view that they just decided that they were going to invade Iraq just in case, just for how I'm interpreting what she's saying.
James, I'm sorry we're losing your cell. We're breaking up. We'll see if we can get you back on. Let's talk with Brandon in Irvine. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi, Elizabeth. My question was about the relationship between George Bush's worldview and Condoleezza Rice's. And what I mean by that is I often feel in reading the news and reading sometimes your stories that she has a kind of different perspective and that she has her hands tied by what the administration's asking of her. And I wondered what you thought about that.
I think there's some truth to that. I think that, you know, in the first term when she was National Security Advisor, she defined her job as, once she said to me, as translating the president's instincts into policy. Well, what that means is she was a super-duper staffer. She wasn't a cabinet member with her own foreign, you know, with her own agency, department. And, you know, the reason I say she was a weak National Security Advisor was that she basically got rolled by Rumsfeld and Cheney, who really were they drove foreign policy in the first term. You know, the hawks drove it, and the president the president also drove it. I mean, in the second term, what is interesting to see is how there's been this about face on so many different policies, and she is now doing many of the things that Colin Powell tried to do, if not all of the things Colin Powell tried to do in the first term that he was shot down on. And so partly she has a lot more power now. Rumsfeld's gone. Cheney is diminished on a number of issues, not all issues. And so I think you can argue that what we're seeing now is something of the real Condi Rice. We're also seeing a woman who is desperately trying to fashion a legacy that is not just the Iraq War, which is why one reason you're seeing so much diplomatic action in the Middle East and attempts in North Korea and some attempts in Iran.
And this is another interesting shift. You're talking earlier about the pragmatic or sort of realist foreign policy view to the spreading of democracy, that she's had a shift in the Middle East, because wasn't it during the first term as National Security Advisor, she was very dubious about the Bush administration making any headway in peace in the Middle East.
Right. There's an interesting the first National Security Council meeting in late January 2001. Bush pipes up, and he's the president. He doesn't pipe up. Bush announces that, you know, he thinks that what Clinton tried to do at the end of his term was he pushed really hard for a peace deal that just made matters worse. And the second Palestinian uprising or intifada occurred because people were so upset about what Clinton had tried to do and it had failed. And so Bush says, we're not going to do that. Clinton just made things worse. Rumsfeld pipes up and says, I agree with you. You know, Cheney says, I agree with you. Colin Powell says, no, we can't keep it. The United States cannot afford to keep a hands-off approach in the Middle East. We're too important there. Condi Rice doesn't say anything. But I asked her later, what did you think? And she said, well, I agreed with the president. You know, she saw this as a futile endeavor. The irony, of course, is 7 years later, she is now pushing just as hard as Clinton once did. Although it's a little different. I've been saying that until recently, because you see that, you know, Bush was over in Israel just recently, over in the Middle East. But you didn't see him in an all-night sessions with both sides trying to hash something out. Of course, it's not the end of his term yet. Maybe we'll see that later this year.
I also wonder about, you know, Iraq sort of blots out almost all of the sun, but we got North Korea and Iran also. And what credit, if any, do you think she's due for North Korea particularly, but also for what's happening in Iran?
I give her credit for North Korea. Again, it doesn't, no one pays as much attention because it's not as dramatic, and it's also very esoteric to a lot of people. But she really did, and her chief negotiator, Christopher Hill, has done a decent job of getting of bringing the North Koreans closer than ever before to, not ever before, but very fairly close to agreeing to give up nuclear weapons. The talks have hit some snags in the last number of days. You know, it's just, but if this is, I think, the biggest chance she has for some success in the next year is on North Korea. Iran is a big problem, that hasn't really borne fruit. But you have to give her credit for at least pushing the president in the spring of 2006 to change our policy, which was we weren't ever going to talk to Iran. And in spring of 2006, she said, no, we now will offer to talk to Iran if Iran stops enriching uranium. Well, Iran hasn't stopped enriching uranium, so you can argue that the condition was too high for talks. But we hadn't even gotten to that point until then.
Well, and also it did seem that she was able to pull Europe a little bit closer.
Yes,
and make some amends there, which might bear some fruit as well. We're almost out of time, and I am so reluctant to bring this up. We had a listener want Jim and Encina wondering about if the relationship between Condoleezza and the president goes deeper than that. We see, you know, I see these tabloid things at the supermarket.
It's like,
where
Laura's
did they get
him out, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's at a motel with a cigarette. Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre, and it's funny in a sense, but do they ever respond to this sort of, you know, conjecture?
No, I don't think anybody's ever asked the president in a press conference or in any kind
way,
of. I certainly
did Laura
never
throw you out?
Right,
now.
Right, yeah. You know, Laura, I can tell you, I saw no evidence of this, but Laura Bush is a very close friend of Condi Rice's. That, you know, it's a family friendship. And, you know, the president has on occasion not helped matters by saying he referred to Condi Rice as his date and what, I can't remember what country they were in not too long ago. You know, they went to some dinner together. So, but no, I can't.
Yeah, the first family don't come across as swingers. So,
no.
Elizabeth Buemiller, thank you very much for joining us. A fascinating look at a very accomplished person professionally, but one whose legacy is certainly up in the air at this point. Condoleezza Rice, An American Life, a biography. New York Times writer Elizabeth Buemiller, a book is published by Random House. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.